Aren't you glad she's here?
A work phone call.
No, I'm glad to see her.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
I saw your wife.
So, welcome to this class called A New Testament, based on the book of that title by Hal Tossig. And I'm going to start tonight with which is either an apology or a mea culpa or maybe just an update. Depends on your perspective. But I wanted to get this out of the way early on because it's going to come up over and again. Over the recent years, as I've been teaching these classes on scripture, on Bible stuff, I've made a lot of references to the Council of Nicaea and its process of creating this canon of sacred literature. And I hadn't gone back and looked at that scholarly research on that subject for some time. I just sort of assumed that, you know, it's 354 CE, it probably hasn't changed much, you know. But it turned out it's wrong. And it turns out that the more modern research suggests that the whole myth about the Council of Nicaea being the place at which the canon was determined was a misunderstanding of what actually happened there. And I'll get into a little bit tonight what that actually was. And we're going to look at a history of the canon and a little more, and then some more recent findings as a part of tonight's class. But I don't want to get to that point and have you say, wait a minute, you said, yeah, I said that, and I was wrong. So, mea culpa or whatever. So, I want to pass out an outline here. You can use to take notes, follow along, or make scratch paper out of, or whatever you want to use it for.
Especially enough, I think mea culpa is the Latin version of my bad.
Yeah, that's exactly it. My bad. And I also want you each to have a copy of this class schedule. It tells you what weeks we're meeting and what we're covering each week.
Well, I mean, should I move over there?
I'm not going to breathe on
this. So that you can, if you wish, read the sections in advance of the class. I'll tell you that each week when we go do these things, I'm not planning on having us read the entire, all the books that are contained in each section. That would take many, many hours. But I am planning on highlighting. My main theme is going to be looking at the subject matter in each of those sections that I've listed there, which are the sections in the book, and overviewing the new content and then comparing and contrasting theological and historical information, containing them to give you some appreciation for how the new books elucidate on content of the old books or conflict with it or clarify it or whatever. There should be plenty of those for everybody. There's 11 copies of everything, I think. Yeah. Or 12.
Anybody will need any more?
Yeah, well, now we don't. Now
I didn't think so. Okay. I think they all have one.
You can. I mean, it's optional. If you're totally fascinated by this stuff and you really want to read it, then that will work very well. But if you don't read it, I'm going to bring in the excerpts that we're going to be studying and so forth. So you don't need to read it in order to enjoy or appreciate the class. But if you read it, you'll enjoy it more. They're exactly in the section order that they're in the book in the table of contents. Those sections titles are the title sections in the book. Yeah. So no, that one there. Those in where it says topics. Those are the subject. Those are the subjects of each section. So I just took them right from that. Yeah. So there shouldn't be any confusion about where we are in the book.
Okay.
Yeah, there is it's available as an Amazon as an ebook or as a printed paperback, and it's if you go to smile.amazon.com, then Unity will get the proceeds of your purchase, but it's not necessary for it to do that. I also want to mention one other book that you may or may not be aware of that is very helpful in this kind of a study. It's a book called The Open Bible. It's only available online. So if you don't do online, it won't do any good. But the Open Bible is a very interesting project done by a small group of biblical scholars who decided, I don't know if you're aware of the fact that when you buy a Bible, it's copyrighted by some organization that subsidize the translation and the publication and the dissemination of it and so forth. So you can't theoretically quote from it in research papers and writings and so forth without getting permission from them, which has kind of hung up some research over the years. This Open Bible is an open source Bible. So the guys who are translating it, and it's not all complete yet, but the entire New Testament is done. So you can take that book, that Bible, and you can reproduce it, you can mail it to people, you can quote from it, you can excerpt from it, and you can change it. If you have a better translation of something, you can do what they call fork it and create a new version of it, a new chapter of it, and it goes up online with the rest of them, and then you can look and see who's been doing better translation work. So it's a completely open source Bible. So that's kind of a cool thing to have if you're into that sort of thing. So let's take a look at the book that we're looking at. Tonight's going to be sort of an overview. We're going to do one of the books as both to give you an example of it and also to get one loose one out of the way. This book is written by or edited and has commentary by Hal Taussig, who's a member of the Jesus Seminars. Y'all familiar with their work. And he had assembled 18 other scholars and church leaders in a series of meetings in New Orleans called the Council of New Orleans. And they met over the space of several months after having done a lot of correspondence prior to actually getting together. And he put together a really interesting system where he asked everybody, all these 18 people, to come up with their list of the most important non-canonical books, that is, books that aren't in the published New Testament as we have it, and to come up with their list of those things and to bring in a conversation about why they were important, what they could add to the canon, and so forth. And they did that in writing, and they did that over several months, and they winnowed the list down to 43 that they then all voted on and had conversations about and so forth to get down to the 10 that ended up in the New Testament. He basically said that there were only two rules that he wanted to follow about selecting manuscripts. One was that they had to be datable before 175 CE, because he arbitrarily decided that's when the sort of latest cutoff date for useful manuscripts was. After that, they started doing a lot of consolidation of things. They weren't doing a lot of original new writing. And that if the manuscripts weren't fairly complete, if they were too fragmentary, he didn't want to include them either, because then there was too much. That's why some of my favorites didn't get in, because they're too fragmentary. So he ended up choosing 10 books for a new Testament. Interestingly enough, he wanted to avoid putting this project together in a way that would seem to prefer either the established books, the canon, or the new books as being better than the other. He wanted them on sort of equal footing. So rather than having, you know, the canon here and then the new stuff here and so forth, or rather than having them try to arrange some chronologically, which is very hard to do because a lot of these are very hard to date, he decided to divide the book up topically. And then he put the books that were out of the canon and the books that came out of the new discoveries in the same section where they were most logically gathered. And then within that, he assembled them in some sort of chronological sequence or teaching sequence so that they made sense. So he starts out, and as he organizes this material, he starts out with a brief introduction to the whole thing in the form of an ancient prayer manuscript that we're going to look in detail at tonight. And he did that because there was a sense of in his group, the Council of New Orleans, that they wanted to start the book with a spiritual, scriptural, celebratory worship kind of an attitude. So that book doesn't really fit into any of the other topics. It's just the introduction to the sort of sets the stage for the rest of the books, if you will. And then the next section, the first section they put in was Gospels that are featuring Jesus' teachings. And the next section is Gospels, Poems, and Songs Between Heaven and Earth, which are other books like Gospels that aren't really Gospels in the sense that they aren't telling the story of Jesus or providing his teachings, but they have other related ancillary material. And then he had the writings of Paul. And then he had the literature in what he called the tradition of Paul, which means that they were sort of Paul-like. They might have been students of Paul's or followers of Paul's or imitators of Paul's or whatever that wrote those things. So, but they're more in the tradition of writing of epistolary or letter writing kind of things. And then he had a section called diverse letters, just other letters that he ran across that seemed to be useful. And there's some of those in the canon too. They're not written by Paul. They're not really in the Pauline tradition. And then the last section is in the literature and the tradition of John, including most notably a book that you probably never heard of called The Secret Revelation of John, We talk about the Revelation, the book of Revelation, which is the last book in the published Bible. This secret revelation of John is a completely different manuscript, a completely different idea. It's got some fascinating things in it. You may be interested in knowing, for example, that the book of Revelation was never really considered an acceptable official part of the New Testament canon until late in the 4th century. And Martin Luther, when he led the Reformation in Catholicism, specifically excluded the book of Revelation from the Bible that he published. He didn't think it had any credibility or any credence.
Did you say Reformation, the book of Revelation?
Reformation, the book of Revelation.
Reformation is the same.
No.
But
Martin Luther was the guy who broke off from the Catholic Church and formed the Protestant movement.
Right. Uh-huh.
And when he did that, he took a lot of his teachings with him. He was a monk. Mm-hmm. He took a lot of his teachings with him, but he left out of the Bible that he was recommending his followers to read did not include the book of Revelation.
Oh.
Because he thought it was he made a comment about it, something like the guy was, you know, sort of hallucinating and it didn't seem to be very coherent. Now, if you've read the book of Revelation, you can agree with Martin Luther on some of those points, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. So every section that I just outlined here contains both canonical and more recently discovered materials interleaved with each other. So if you were going to tackle this as a year-long subject, which we're not, you would want to read every book in those sections in the order in which you present them, because they're interrelated to each other in a very specific way, and it kind of comes through. If you really wanted to do that, if you came out of this class and said, man, I really want to immerse myself in this stuff, this is cool, he has a study guide in the back of the book where you recommend several specific courses to study with very detailed directions about different approaches you can take to it depending on what your objectives are and so forth. But we're not going to go that route, of course, unless a whole bunch of people wanted to. One of the interesting things about this is reading these books, the canon and the newly discovered materials next to each other, opens up a lot of possibilities for cross-pollination of meanings and ideas. And you'll see as we go through some of the first stuff, especially in the first couple of weeks, where one of the newly discovered books, the new manuscripts, the non-canonicals, will shed light on something that you've had trouble with in reading one of the standard canonical gospel accounts. Oh, I see how that hooks up. I see how that relates back. I see what that's connected to. I see where that came from. And it'll be very, very revealing. You have a few insights like that. It really makes you appreciate the quality of what they've done here. And then, as Sue said earlier, at the back of the book, the collection of books, there's a section called A Companion to a New Testament, which is an overview of how the New Testament, the canon, came into being, how this came into being, a lot of background information on the books and some of the arguments that they had about it. And tonight's class what I'm presenting here tonight basically comes out of that section of the book, along with some supplemental materials. So any questions about the book and what we're going to encounter here?
This secret revelation of John, is that believed to be written by the same person as the revelation that we know?
It's attributed to him to the same degree, with the same degree of certainty as the revelation is, which is to say not much.
But would they have the same author, though?
His Taussig's conclusion is that they were at least anciently considered to be authored by the same person. Anything else? Okay, so let's take a look at the question of how these extra-canonical, non-canonical books were discovered. Now, there were a lot of different discoveries that took place over the course of a number of years, but the most important, undoubtedly the most important discovery, was the cache of documents at Nag Hammadi. And you all heard the story, the legend of that, how they were found in a jar in a cave, and there were a lot of manuscripts there, and a peasant guy took them home and was tearing out pages to build fires with them, and somebody else came along and said, oh, those could be valuable. That original library was a jar containing 52 documents, and they were not all from early Christianity. A lot of them were, but not all of them were. There's this book called the Nag Hammadi Library, which is all of the definitive translations of all of the manuscripts found there in one volume by James Robinson. This is considered the gold standard for reading and interpreting the Nag Hammadi Library. And as I was pointing out before class, you know that this isn't a collection of just Christian books, because one of the manuscripts found in the Nag Hammadi Library was the Republic by Plato. So there were other ones there, but that's one you would know the most.
What was the author of that again?
James M. Robinson. general editor. Those 52 documents were contained in this jar. They were bound into 12 codices, codices, which are words, so basically books, only they're outsized, and one parcel, which was a container of loose pages that were just sort of bound around with a leather thong or some dumb thing. Translating the books, all of the manuscripts in the Nag Hammadi Library took 30 years. So it was found in 1945, and over 30 years, this stuff all got translated. And the first compilation of translations into English was published in 1978. So this is a really recent scholarship we're talking about here. You know, I think everybody in this room was probably born in by 1978. So it's in our lifetimes that this stuff is going on. There were manuscripts in Coptic, which is an Egyptian language. There were manuscripts in Greek. There were some manuscripts in Latin, so there were a mixture of languages. And in fact, some manuscripts were written in mixed languages.
But none of them were originals.
These are all copies of copies of copies. This is like, you know, this is being found in 1945. They can't date the manuscripts any earlier than about the 8th or 9th century. These are copies of things that have been going on for a long time. We have no original documents of any scripture. Anybody who tells you want to go back to the original manuscript is blowing smoke.
To translate it.
That's just in English.
Right.
There were other languages that were also being worked on. Seven of the 10 books that are in a New Testament, the non-canonicals, came from that Nag Hammadi collection. So that's the vast majority of the stuff that we're going to be dealing with in this class. But there were three books that didn't fit that profile that I found rather interesting, and they have their own individual stories, so I'd like to share those briefly with you. One of the books that appears in the New Testament in a very unusual way, it is called the Odes of Solomon. It's divided into four different segments in the New Testament because it's got a lot of scope and a lot of depth, and it's a lot of poetry. Part of worship services in the main. But we have no idea where it came from. We have no idea how the manuscript that was translated into this book came from. Because the professor who's credited with finding it, his name was J. Rendell Harris, was rummaging through his office, which apparently not very well organized, around 1909, and he stumbled across this book. And he said, "Wonder where I got this." He had no memory of where it came from, how he got it. He reflected on it. He said, "I think somebody told me it came from someplace in Egypt, but I'm not really sure." So there's no way to trace the origins of this manuscript. It just sort of shows up in this guy's library, piled under some desk or something. It's really pretty strange. But over the next few years, other scholars authenticated the book as being an authentic New Testament or authentic first century Christian kind of a document based on writing style. And based on extensive quotations that it contains from another well-authenticated and famous book called Pistis Sophia. So there were a lot of quotations in the Odes of Solomon from Pistis Sophia, which had already been sanctioned as a legitimate book. So that lent its credibility to this.
What's that first word?
Pistis, P-I-S-T-I-S. P-I-S-T-I-S, Pistis.
Pistis.
Of Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'll be darned.
Pistis Sophia.
You know what that means?
I have no idea.
Must be related to the word.
I could find out, but I didn't look up. It's just the title of the book. Maybe it's you know, somebody named first name Pistis. I don't know.
Might be a flower.
Somebody will go check Google now and tell me in 5 minutes, but I didn't go and investigate.
Marianne's like, I'm on it.
Marianne's all over it, man. So that's one of the three books that doesn't come out of Nag Hammadi, and it's sort of provenance. The second book that was interesting that didn't come from Nag Hammadi was the Gospel of Mary. This book was found in Cairo, where it was sold at a market to a German collector who took it to Germany to have it translated. Unfortunately, his arrival in Germany with this manuscript coincided with the start of the Third Reich and the World War II. So for many years, this book laid around, nobody working on it because nobody could figure it out. I mean, nobody was going to get permission or authorization to publish anything like that anyway at that time. So it just sort of stayed there, and it got lost once or twice, and people couldn't figure out where it was. It was stored in some warehouse or something like that. Then the first translator who was working on this book got nearly done and died. And apparently didn't leave much of his notes for anybody to follow. So
died?
Yes. No, he died of a disease. Okay. The plague, I think.
Yeah, the Nazis.
And the total time from the day this manuscript shows up in Germany from the Cairo market to be translated to the time it was actually translated into German along with a commentary was 60 years. 1955, the manuscript first appears in German. And of course, later on, then we translate it into other languages and so forth, and we have the Gospel of Mary now in English as well. That's not in the Nag Hammadi Library book because it's not part of the Nag Hammadi Library.
60 years
from the time it was discovered till we had the first translation and commentary in German. Then in the third book, this is really a strange one. It's called The Acts of Paul and Thecla, T-H-E-C-L-A. You'll find this one of the most interesting books in this study that we're going to do together. The Acts of Paul and Thecla. Now, this manuscript was never lost, so nobody had to discover it. It was always in existence from the time it was first known. It never got lost. It never got misplaced. There was always copies of it laying around. People were reading it and sharing it. So in the churches in Syria, particularly in the Christian church movement in Syria and in the Eastern Orthodox movement, this was a very popular, very widespread book. Well, we can't date the book exactly because we don't have an original manuscript, but somewhere in the first 2 to 4 centuries or so. Yeah.
But they tried to stay within the years up to 170.
175 CE, right. So
something,
something that was written in that area, right. Yeah, exactly, right.
So they're written, they're thinking they're written within that area.
Right. It was being widely read in the second century. We know that because there was a very famous Christian scholar and writer named Tertullian, whose name will go down in infamy, who attacked this manuscript along with many others as being heretical, and that's probably why it didn't get picked up as part of the not only as part of the canon, but it wasn't even in the discussions. He declared it heretical. He was a significant leader. That was it. So presumably that's why it didn't make it into the canon. But that one was never lost. But when these scholars formed the Council of New Orleans and started looking at all these books, this one came up as one that was very important. And you'll find that it's very important primarily because it has an incredibly strong female character who acts in some incredibly counterintuitive, countercultural political ways as a part of what the contents of the book. It's a very interesting story. So that's the provenance of the 10 books that we're going to be looking at that are new to us in this New Testament. Any questions there?
So it must have had a lot of significance if there are copies everywhere, because it was very difficult. How long is this?
Well, it was being talked about in the second century. And so
this, how long is this?
You mean how long is the book?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can find out.
No, I mean, guesstimate. I mean,
It's not a huge book.
It's not like they had a printing press to be able
no.
to. No,
that's right. But
the
people were making hand copies in the monasteries.
It must have been
exactly
significant.
And that was one of the points that Taussig and his colleagues made in adopting it as part of the New Testament, was that it obviously took some labor and focus and desire to keep it alive all that time. So that must mean it was significant and important. There was apparently very little debate about it at his conference. A lot of people. Remember what I told you when he had everybody make a list of the books that they would put in. It appeared on almost all the lists in the first draft, so it was considered pretty important. So, anything else? Okay. Now let's take a look at the question of how the New Testament canon came to be.
The original,
the one that we're going to be amplifying here, right?
What year did that come out?
What?
What year did Canada start?
Oh, that's what we're going to talk about. Oh. It's got a very long history.
I'm just saying.
Early on in the history, and if you had the book, I can show you where it is in here. I think
you don't get direct questions. You don't get direct answers here. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Very few. Very few.
Neither do I at home. Go look it up. Look it up.
So early on, what we had was there were a lot of different church leaders who are trying to focus in on what's important, what's the canon, what should people read, what can we recommend, what is good theology, what is garbage, what is inaccurate, what doesn't uphold our perspectives on things, whatever their criteria might be known. So there were a series of lists that were published by various people during the first part of the Christian early Christian church. The first one known was a guy named Marcion, M-A-R-C-I-O-N. Sometimes pronounced Marcion. That was in the middle of the second century, around 150 or so. And he looked at all of the books that were circulating at that time and claiming some official status. And he said all of it was crap, except for Paul's letters and a few pieces of Luke. That was it. So he told his followers, and that wrote letters and articles for dissemination of the churches, don't rely on anything that isn't written by Paul or doesn't appear in these few verses of Luke that I've decided that are appropriate. Remember now, the early church, these are bishops who have a lot of sway in their areas where they're in control. The next guy who comes along historically, at least chronologically, is a guy named Irenaeus, who was the bishop of Lyon in France. He didn't like Marcion's list at all. And he was the first one to designate Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as authoritative gospels. Now, the interesting thing about that is somebody asked him, because there were 100 gospels floating around this time, or at least dozens of gospels floating around this time, that could be candidates for inclusion. And somebody said to him, why four? And he said, well, there are four corners of the earth, and the wind blows from the four directions, so it makes sense that the gospel truth would come in force.
Well, that's very logical.
Very logical. Completely irrational.
That's a ring of truth.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. So that was his idea. That was his list. And then in the late second century, there was a Syrian theologian named Tatian, T-A-T-I-A-N. He did something really interesting. He took those four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which, as we all know who have studied them in modernity, have a lot of conflicts and overlaps and duplications and so forth in them. And he sort of cut and pasted them into one harmonizing document called the Diatessaron, which is very famous.
Diatessaron.
D-I-A-T-E-S-S-E-R-O-N, Diatessaron. And his objective in creating that document was to calm all the concerns that were arising in the Christ communities of the time about the conflicts among the Gospels and how it was affecting their credibility in the communities where they were trying to preach the good news. And then late second century, I told you that that's about the same time as Tatian, I think a few years later, Clement of Alexandria, who's one of the most famous Christian early Christian leaders of all, wrote a book in which he said only Matthew and John were to be accepted as gospel accounts, because the belief he had then was that only those two were written by apostles, Matthew and John. If you look at the listings of all the apostles, there's no Matthew. There's never an apostle called Mark or Luke. So he said those can't be apostolic traditions, so we're not going to pay attention to those. We're going to pay attention only to Matthew and John, because there was a apostle called Matthew and there was one called John. Now, here's where the Council of Nicaea confusion comes up for us. This council, which you'll recall was commissioned by Constantine, his goal was to consolidate Christian teachings in one set of coherent rules and thoughts so he could declare that to be the empire's official religion without any splintering and disagreements and so forth among all these. And at this time, you have to picture the Christian church was made up of all these bishops. There were like, I think, 32 bishops. All these bishops had sort of influence over their own geographic regions, and each one of them had different lists of books that were going to be done, different teachings. Some places they thought that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Some places they said he had a substitute who served, who took his place on the cross. Other places they said he never really died. I mean, there were all kinds of Christology disagreements. This was a very fragmented church. It was a movement that was still trying to find its identity. So Constantine created this council. And where the confusion comes in about the canon is at the same time he commissioned a historian of his named Eusebius, who, by the way, is also the historian of record for the Council of Nicaea. And that's why it's confusing. He said he wanted him to create a list of books that the Christian churches would follow and that we could get rid of all those dozens or hundreds of other books that were out there. Eusebius didn't feel up to the task of determining sanctity because he wasn't a Christian. He was a Roman historian. So he did. He went around and talked to people, and he asked them to evaluate these books and tell him what their character was. And then he made three lists. He made a list that was called recognized. And in that list were Mark, Luke, John, Acts, 14 of Paul's letters, 1 Peter, and 1 John. So those, he said those are recognized. He wasn't recognizing those. See where the confusion comes in? He wasn't recognizing those. He was reporting those as recognized by the people he talked to in the council. The Christian leaders who were gathered there at Nicaea. So he basically took a poll.
Yeah.
And then he kept, the second list he had was called Disputed. And the disputed books were James and Jude, 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John. James, Jude, 2 Peter, and 2 and 3 John. And then there was a title, a category he called Spurious. Yeah, as in...
Like spurious.
Yeah. Exactly.
Spurious.
And that one included these books, none of which made it into the canon, but some of which are viewed by modern scholars as being valuable. The Acts of Paul, the Apocalypse of Peter, and the Teaching of the 12 Apostles. Interestingly, the book of Revelation appeared both on the disputed list and on the spurious list. So even that far back, nobody could make up their mind about it.
The book of Revelation
was on both lists, yeah. Oh. Disputed and spurious.
So there must be a whole story about how it got into the canon.
Oh, I'm sure there is, yeah.
Would you define spurious?
Spurious means sporadic, kind of not really founded on anything.
Questionable.
Questionable, dubious. Yeah. Right. Dubious, yeah. So, after the Council of Nicaea, there were a number of other councils and what were called synods, which were very similar kinds of things. Some of those agreed on a list of 27 books, the ones that are in today's canon. Others disputed many books' inclusion. Several of them were 26 books, leaving out Revelation. And then at the turn of the 4th century, the Bishop of Alexandria, who was probably the most powerful bishop outside of Rome, his name was Athanasius. He produced this list, that the first list that included all 27 books in the current New Testament and no others.
Who did that?
Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria. That's early 4th century, turn of the 4th century, early 4th century.
And when was the Council of Nicaea?
345, so mid-4th century.
Bishop of
Alexandria.
Okay, and you're saying... Early 4th century, so before the Council of Nicaea?
Athanasius would be, I think Athanasius precedes the Council of Nicaea.
Can
right.
I ask you something?
Sure, go ahead.
Didn't Constantine, wasn't he the one who took away past lives from the teachings of Christianity? Wasn't it Constantine?
Constantine didn't touch the teachings of Christianity. He commissioned other people to go figure this out and bring back to me one set of teachings because he didn't want to have a fragmented empire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
I think what you're thinking is that during the Council of Nicaea, the question of previous prior life, past lives was brought up and was not accepted as part of the Christian teachings.
Oh.
But that wasn't Constantine himself doing that. Constantine never showed up at this council. He just commissioned it, put him in the, said, give me a report. Tell me what's happening
delegated.
Here. Right.
Did that include the Old Testament? Or
just no, just the New Testament.
The Old Testament
has been set for a very long time. It was set by Judaism, and it's never been really disputed.
All the New Testament.
That's right, all the New Testament. And then, of course, later on, it's the intertestamental books of Catholicism that come into play, but they're really considered part of the New Testament as well by them. So, about the same time as Athanasius, there's the Bishop of Jerusalem, who was the third highest, most influential guy in Christianity at that time. Listed 26 books, eliminating Revelation. So here's the state of things, right? By the 4th century, there was still no agreed-upon canon. But any apostle, I want to point out, any apostle or anyone claiming personal knowledge of an apostle would have been long gone by then. So what's the basis of the authority that these lists are being created? Well, what basis? And the only basis was street cred.
Or personal agenda.
But with in terms of their credibility in the Christian community, they couldn't claim apostolic succession or apostolic influence. They could only claim that they had credibility from other things that they were teaching, and they were revered by their communities, and so they were able to feel that they could declare a canon, which otherwise would probably not have happened.
Would you say again how many they sort of started with? They boiled down to this 27 or 26?
There were over 200 books altogether. But when the New Orleans Council first started getting together, they had 43. 43 on the list that they had all agreed those were the ones they'd debate about.
Right. That's the number I forgot.
Yep.
That's the New Testament. Right.
Yep. Anybody have any other questions or comments before we move on? Yeah.
How many books are in the Old New Testament?
In the canon, 27.
27,
so they have all the 26 books that were on all those lists, plus
so how
Revelation.
How many books were around then? Hundreds?
Oh, hundreds.
Hundreds. So they
there were hundreds of just gospel accounts. I mean, there were at least, by some accounts, there were at least 200 gospels around. The Nag Hammadi Library, which is only a fraction of this material, I mean, there's only 52 manuscripts there, contains 12 accounts that call themselves Gospels in the Nag Hammadi Library, which is a tiny fraction of the whole extant literature at the time. So clearly there were at least a couple of hundred around. I think that I read someplace that somebody actually had compiled a list of all the books that had the word Gospel in the title, or had teachings of Jesus as part of the title, so you could consider them as being Gospels, and there were over 200.
So
some of those are only like, you know, fragments this big.
So was the Dedsky Scrolls part of the, was that all part of the canon that were?
No, Dead Sea Scrolls is all Old Testament stuff.
That's
there's
all
no nothing about the New Testament and Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are only Old Testament, right.
That's part of the canon.
It's part of the Old Testament canon, right. Yep. But that is the Old Testament canon.
No, nothing new, no New Testament.
Not a thing. No, it predates all that stuff, yep.
So if Constantine hadn't ever done that, what would Christianity look like today? Would it even be?
Probably not. I think a lot of historians would argue that Constantine, although he obviously governed with a heavy hand and was kind of a meat cleaver when it came to how to deal with finite issues, consolidated Christianity, made it possible for it to become a single movement that could then sweep the world, which was the fragmented churches of the second, third, fourth centuries could never have done that. They didn't agree with each other. I mean, on a lot of stuff, not just on canon, but on Christology and who were the apostles, and what was Mary's role. And there were major disputes about significant points of theology among those churches early on. And when Constantine decided that he was going to adopt Christianity as the empire's religion, but only if they could get their act together and have one set of teachings that they could agree on, he forced him into a position of consolidate or die.
So, what is the empire you're referring to?
Roman Empire.
Okay.
So why was the Council of Nicaea a myth?
So the Council of Nicaea is not a myth. My statement that at the Council of Nicaea, they had these votes about the canon and how they were voted in and out and so forth, that's all a misconstruction of Eusebius's historical work. And the problem is he was the one recording it. So a lot of early scholarship drew an incorrect conclusion that the canon had been voted on at the Council of Nicaea, but it really wasn't a vote among the council members. It was Eusebius taking the temperature of the groups and getting some idea what books went where. So it got sort of conflated later on, and I just never went back and looked at it again. So
question.
Yep.
Is there any evidence that once these lists were made up and the 27 was identified, that the ones that were disputed, etc., were actively suppressed?
Yes, there's a lot of evidence of that effect.
There was clearly
a lot of it was destroyed, intentionally or otherwise. At least there was no attempt to preserve it for certain.
Just plain luck on our part that somebody.
That's what that Nag Hammadi finding was obviously some. There's a belief that one set of historical beliefs is that there was a monastery near there, and that they took these disputed books and put them in this earthen jar and put them in the cave to prevent them being destroyed by the church forces that were coming into their area to sort of decimate that stuff. It does.
Did the King James Version bury any of this, or did it just take it as it
was? Oh, it just took it as it was.
They just translated it.
That's right. So here's the bottom line that's interesting here, okay? The first actual New Testament, published New Testament, was produced at least 700 years after Jesus' death. At least 700 years, maybe more. And as recently as 600 years ago, okay, that's not in our lifetime, but that's fairly recent history as biblical and archaeological history goes. The Catholic Council at Trent and its Protestant counterparts declared what should be in the canon, and they were not the same. Catholicism has a different canon, set of canon than does Protestantism. They have a whole set of books that are called, we call them intertestamental books. They're all basically historical books, but they're there.
Maccabees.
And Maccabees is the best known. And those are the canons. So that's only 600 years ago. So all of this, so what does that tell you? That tells you that all these people who go around claiming that the New Testament as we have it is the Word of God as originally transcribed and perfect in every sense and never... They just have no idea what they're doing. They have no idea what they're talking about. Because nobody, throughout the history of the church, until 600 years ago, nobody ever said that.
If English was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for me.
That's right. I had a friend one time in a debate with me say that that the King James Version was good enough for Paul, it was good enough for him. And he was dead serious.
Say that again.
He said that if the King James Version was good enough for Paul, it was good enough for him.
Who said that?
A friend of mine was having a debate with one time. Are you crazy?
Where to even begin?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's not even, there's no debate at that point.
That's
just, nice. Yeah. Yeah.
My grandmother.
Well, what I'm getting from this is almost like saying that the New Testament isn't the truth.
No, that's not the.
That's what I'm getting at.
That's what I'm trying to say. The New Testament. The point is that the New Testament isn't the whole. We don't have in the New Testament as we have it today. We don't have all of the truth that was available about Jesus and his teachings, about the acts of his apostles, about all the early Christian church history, about methods of worship and style of prayer and so on. That was all a part of the Christian ethic that came out of that first through fourth centuries, okay. Because too much of it was not included in the canon. And worship, as Patty said earlier, suppressed. So it couldn't even be, it would have been one thing to say, okay, these are the holy books. We're sprinkling holy water on these. You can study these. You guys who preach, you can preach from these. Here's another whole bunch of literature that's probably help you if you really want to study this stuff, but don't try to teach from it or quote from it or build your faith on it because there's too much shady stuff here. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do that. They said, here's the truth. The rest of the stuff is getting tossed in the pit.
So how do we know the truth about of Jesus then? How do we know that Jesus even existed?
We don't.
We don't. We don't really.
We don't know for sure.
Isn't there some historical evidence?
No,
no, not really.
The truth of it is
there's only one reference in history to the existence of Jesus that doesn't come from the gospel accounts, which were obviously prejudiced. Mm-hmm. Right?
We've been exactly where you are right now.
Just hang on, because it's a
There was a Jewish historian named Josephus who wrote a history of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. He was Roman, but he wrote a history of the Jewish people. And he mentions in one sentence the notion of a person named Jesus from Galilee having been brought to trial in front of Herod. One sentence, which it turns out by looking at the text content and so on, was inserted hundreds of years after he wrote the book. So there's no contemporaneous record at all that says Jesus as a person existed. Doesn't mean he didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could look at this and say there was a guy named Jesus. We could look at this and say, well, Jesus is a stand-in for a lot of teachings, and it was just maybe he was the leader of the movement. We don't know. We have no. So you take that issue, the issue of Jesus' existence, his virgin birth, his death and resurrection, and so, and you take that all. That's a question of faith. That's just faith, and you know what? You can have faith in anything you want to in that area, and it's perfectly fine.
That's the amazing thing about this is that. Here's a book I was taught was the truth, right? God speaking, this is it. This is the story, right? And then I hear the four Gospels tell the story four different ways.
Five different ways.
We learned that.
And now you've got things told five different ways and other stories that weren't included that are saying things in really different ways, and it's just like, wow.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
And you have to remember the party tricks of whispering in one another's ears and how the statement turns out at the end.
Well,
other end. And that's what's been happening for 2,000 years.
Yeah, but the question I'm having behind all of that is that this has lasted so long over centuries.
Sure it has.
To this day.
Yes.
So something about this. No question about it.
And what really happened was.
Nobody, it's almost like when I tell my friend at work, he's Jewish, but he's my friend, and he says, that story that you Christians believe in about Adam and Eve, it just blows me. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, guess what? Guess what? That's Jewish teaching.
Yeah, that's Jewish.
That's not Christian teaching. That's Jewish teaching.
Well, okay. I'm just saying.
This is not a very well-studied Jew.
Tell your friend he needs to go to synagogue more.
A snake talking. Do you really believe that?
When is Paul's writing?
Paul started writing in around 150, 130 to 150, and his last writing was at 175 or thereabouts. He wrote for a period of about 12 to 14 years, and it's hard to tell when it started.
This isn't the Paul that was at that time.
This isn't the Paul.
This isn't the Paul that was at the time of Jesus.
Yeah.
You said 175.
So here's the thing. We have this story of Paul. He's not an apostle. He never meets Jesus.
No,
he's not physically around. He comes along a lot later. We don't know exactly how much later because there's no documentation on it. But at some point later, he comes along. Okay? You asked a question about his letters and where they were written.
Yeah.
The letters were all written probably in the period of between 50 and 70.
So that would have been Paul real.
Yes, right. Okay. Yeah, I thought you were talking about the whole epistolary literature. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Writing, so he was a contemporary of Jesus.
No, nope. he was a generation after Jesus.
Yeah,
oh,
he was
a generation after.
Right. So he would have come along. So Jesus dies apparently around 33.
Yeah.
We're not sure about the date of the year, but let's say 33. And Paul has his encounter with Jesus and begins his ministry somewhere around 40 or 50.
Oh, okay.
So we don't know. There's a gap in there. We don't know how long that is.
So
it could be 6 weeks or it could
be. Wasn't
right. He wasn't a contemporary. He only encountered Jesus in spirit.
But he had that. It was such a huge encounter.
Yeah, Paul's life was radically changed by it.
Yeah.
You know, he was a Pharisee persecuting Christians until he had that encounter on the Damascus Road.
His writings had to come from
another class.
That don't make sense to me.
What doesn't make sense, Keith?
I mean, if he never met Jesus, and yet you say he is spirit, whatever happened.
Right.
And how can Paul write from my hearing that now people saying that Paul's writing is based on hearsay from different people before his time?
Paul declared himself an apostle of Jesus by personal acclamation of Jesus himself, whom he encountered in as a risen spirit on the Damascus Road experience. Okay? So he says, wasn't around when Jesus was on earth. I didn't get a chance to meet him. I didn't follow his teaching. But he taught me, and through a couple of other people played earlier roles in Paul's life, he taught me all this Christian stuff. And I'm going to go out and spread this to all of the non-Jewish world. That was his role. He was going to spread the word of Jesus, of the gospel message into the Gentile community. That was his thing. And he said he got a commission to do that from Jesus during that Damascus Road experience or soon thereafter, okay? So that's where his inspiration for this comes. Now, I'll make one more observation that I've made this group before, but you may not have been here. The modern church, modern Christian church, is way more Pollyannity than it is Christianity. Mm. Almost all of the modern theology that we have comes from the letters of Paul. Jesus didn't write any books.
True.
Other people wrote down his words 50 or more years after he died. So what we have is Paul expounding to all these different, explaining the applications of these ideas to all these churches that he had founded all over the Middle East, up even into Rome. And that's the centerpiece of the theology of the Christian church today. The letters of Paul are way more important than the Gospels to them. They don't say that, but that's really the case.
But it would have been, as we just said, it was by then it was oral tradition.
Right.
That was written later on.
See, when the apostles were hanging around after Jesus dies, and if you believe that, gets resurrected and ascended, they believed that Jesus would reinstate the kingdom on earth in their lifetimes. He as much as said so, as they understood it. So a number of years go by, and the apostles are dying off, and pretty soon there's only a couple of them left. They're going, you know what? I don't think he's coming back, right? Maybe we should write some of this stuff down so it doesn't get forgotten when we die. And that's when the oral tradition gets written down for the first time, and only to preserve it because they didn't know what was going to happen next.
I just heard that today on the radio.
Oh.
This minister talking deals with all on the radio.
Yep.
You just said those words. Mm. You said that's how that came.
That was him.
What was the book? There's a book written, about Jesus the activist. I don't know what the name of it is, right? Jesus as an activist.
Yep.
And it explains how in those early days, right? I don't know if it's a story, so I don't know. It's based on, it's very well
researched. Yep.
Researched,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
With that, you had all these groups of Christians that, you know, were real believers and had it, you know, were on fire with Jesus, but they were all destroyed by this fighting, right?
Right.
You know, all the wars that were happening, all those early people that were really on fire with Jesus and that feeling were destroyed.
What book is that?
What's the name of that book?
Remember.
I can't remember.
It's fiction.
Vicky.
It is. It's a novel, but it's a well-researched novel.
It's
an historical novel.
But it's a very
historical novel. Yeah.
There are several of those,
very
by
well
the way.
Researched.
Yes.
Very well researched. It's really good. I'll figure it out.
But you're not talking about the Gospel of what's the Biff? What's it?
No, the Gospel according to Biff. No.
No.
That's another whole account. That's fun too.
But it has a lot of stuff in there too. And she's not talking about Aslan. No, she's talking about.
No, right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
No.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't want to get into that tonight because that's going into a whole other area. But those of you who are regular students in my classes know that I believe there's a sufficient amount of evidence to suggest that from the time Jesus left the temple under the age of 12, when he was made his bar mitzvah, as it were, until he returns at the age of 30 and his public ministry begins, he spent those 18 years in India.
Zealot. Jesus the zealot.
The zealot.
Yeah, Jesus the zealot.
He's talking about.
That's right.
That's not a novel.
No, that's a nonfiction work. There's another book that another
that's what
yeah,
I read that.
That's an amazing book.
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
He was
didn't like it.
Neither did the rest of the church. The Zealot is a book about Jesus, mm-hmm. as which positions him as a revolutionary of the first century.
Yeah. Oh. It's actually just Zealot.
Good.
So. Well, we're not going to talk about that tonight. Okay. I taught a whole class on that a couple of years ago, and I would be happy to do something on it again. But I think for tonight, it would put us out of the context of this class to do that. So.
There's also the Quran that chronicles the Arabian, the way the Arabs told the story, and they retained it in their own language. Fascinating.
They are.
Amazing
and very credible.
Yep.
Because they lived contemporarily and their language has not changed that much. And so what was written down eventually following Muhammad's teaching, which was quite a bit later, are well worth reading.
Yep, I agree.
When did the idea begin that the Bible was the infallible word of God? When did that start to get disseminated?
It depends on who you listen to, but the best that I can figure for my own purposes, for my own beliefs, is that it started happening in the early 20th century when Calvinism and what's the other one? The other mainstream the two main thrusts of Protestantism. No, Lutheranism. No. Started to hold sway and needed the authority of that kind of an imprimatur to hold their flocks in control.
So before that, it was understood that these were writings? It wasn't...
I think that you could safely say that the majority of people, at least Christian scholars and leaders, would have seen the words of the scripture as inspired but not dictated. The idea that Jesus, that these men who wrote these books did that under direct dictation, those automatic writing, without them being consciously involved in it or their opinions being any part of it, would have been a really anathema idea to most of the early church because they didn't put those people on a pedestal. See, what you effectively do theologically is you say if the prophets, for example, the Old Testament prophets, you say they wrote those books exactly as they were dictated by God and their hand moved and they didn't have anything to say about it, you put them on the same level as God. You basically deify them. And that would have been an idea that neither Judaism nor early Christianity would have had any truck with. So, that came later.
When I was reading back there, I had a sense, this might be really off, but you know how the Jewish people, the rabbis, they talk and discuss things, right?
Right.
I had a sense that that's what was going on. In the early times, and then somebody came along and said, "No, this is it." You know, but
right.
The discussion's over. This is the truth. This is God,
right.
And they're trying to get back here to put this together so that discussion can happen.
Yep,
again.
That's right. That's right. That's,
so
that's pretty accurate.
Our own midrash.
Right?
And
our own midrash.
That's
Judaism never closed the book.
Right.
Judaism never closed the book. They're still doing midrash today.
They're still.
I mean, well-known rabbis publish books that have new teachings. Whoa, that's kind of cool. How's that relate to this over here? And they have debates about that. That's what rabbis do. They debate.
Kabbalah.
To no end, they debate. I've been in the room with some of them. But it's a really fascinating way to deal with religious belief is that there's nobody has the answer. We're all looking for it together.
But it's a possibility, which is my opinion, that in all that's going on around here, all whatever, there could be a little bit of truth in everybody.
Sure there is.
Of course.
That makes up the whole.
That's what we've been teaching.
That's basically what I really think. There's nobody, no one section is wrong.
Nobody has all the
everybody
truth.
Got a little been a piece of everything.
That's
and
right.
It's got to be that way for some reason. I really believe that.
Because we're all one.
Yeah, at this point, you
totally.
Just, yeah.
In fact, near the end of the class tonight, I'll propose a reason why that might be true.
You just have to trust that there's something inside that knows. There's an inner wisdom inside you that
everybody
goes
knows.
Click.
Yeah. I agree.
When you
I
hear
agree
it,
with that.
You know
we
it.
Dance
you recognize it, and it's...
Because otherwise, I get frustrated
yeah.
and listen to all these different opinions. So it makes me feel like I this really, there are times I get so emotional about this thing. For me, I'm alone and I think about it, and I meditate and I pray, and I just feel that something bothers me about all this confusion. Really, it does. It really. It's like I think about this divine spirit, this thing that we call God, and it seems like, why can't we get this together? Why the lies? Why the stories and whatever? People's lives, I won't say at stake, but it's important.
Oh, yeah, simple. So there's a simple explanation, and that is that all of these institutions are run by humans who have other agendas.
But then,
including this one, by the way.
When we were in the other class about the teachings of unity from that book, the Heart-Centered Metaphysics, it said the way to go is to try to imitate Christ, try to live like Christ.
Exactly.
So, you know, whether he existed or not or whatever, we're meant to sort of follow what was said. So there was some wisdom there.
Follow the example.
Follow the teachings, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay,
which you have to work out for yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, let's take a look at the new books that made it into the New Testament then. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on them here, but I want to give you a sort of an overview of their influence. So taken as a whole, the question I want to ask is, what do the 10 new books added to a New Testament bring to the discussion and experience of Christianity in the 21st century? And Tostig offers the following insights. He says, first of all, including these new books reduces the credibility of those who teach that the New Testament canon offers only one way of celebrating and observing Jesus. It disturbs the so-called master narrative that tells the story of Christianity as if its triumph were inevitable and it were the only way. By presenting, within the context of the Christian church and Christian teachings, other ideas, other approaches, other worship techniques, and so forth. Secondly, he says, some of the new books, particularly the Odes of Solomon that I referred to earlier, that's scattered in four different places in this book, and the prayer we'll deal with this evening, which is called the Prayer of Thanksgiving, give us really great insight into how early Christ communities, he calls them Christ communities, worshipped and governed themselves. In the New Testament canon that we have, those topics are largely non-existent. There's not much discussion about it. There's a very brief mention in Acts of their holding property in common and what happens if you don't go along with that. But other than that, not much. But there are some of the material we're going to run through in these books talks about how those people came together to worship, what the experience was like, how they governed themselves. And then third, he says, spiritually, several of these new books that are in the New Testament greatly expand on the I am of Christ that is near and dear to my heart and a focus of my book. Particularly an amazing and powerful book called The Thunder, Perfect Mind, which we're going to get into, I think, in the second week, offers a number of new Jesus sayings and teachings on the subject of the I am, as of course, so does the Gospel of Thomas. So we'll see as we proceed through the next 5 weeks of exploration many specific teachings of Jesus and his followers and many ways that these books clarify, expand, deepen, and depict ways of life and worship that really enrich the Christ experience in ways that are that transcend the canonical New Testament, and I hope will enrich your life and your experience of the Christ Spirit in you and the Jesus message. Now, are there contradictions? Yep.
There's contradictions in the Bible.
Exactly. In fact, there's quite a few. But what you'll find as we uncover some of these is that these contradictions often point to paradoxes in early Christianity, in early Christ community teachings, from which we can learn their meanings more deeply. You know, Vicki's teachings about paradox, right?
Right.
Both and.
Yep, if you have a two things that seem to be true conflict with each other, it's a calling to take a step up and look at it from a higher perspective, which she calls the both and perspective. So, okay, before finishing this introduction, this introductory subject and moving into our first actual new book, I want to say a few words about Gnosticism. The Nakamati Library, this is the original, I told you this is the gold standard. The subtitle of this book is The Definitive Translation of the Gnostic Scriptures. The idea that the Nakamati Library contains only Gnostic literature should have been clearly wrong, seen as clearly wrong from the beginning by virtue of the fact that it contained Plato's Republic, which is hardly a Gnostic piece of literature.
What do you mean? I still, you know, even though...
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to clarify it. Right. You still may not understand it, but I'm going to clarify it.
All right.
Now, Taussig is a really well-known opponent of the idea that most or all of these rediscovered books are Gnostic in nature. That's a fairly recent strain of scholarly research and thinking, but I think he's right. As much as he admires Elaine Pagels, for example, who wrote a book called The Gnostic Gospels that we've all read and probably studied, he didn't invite her to his council at New Orleans, largely because of her popularization of the idea that these new documents were a cohesive set of teachings that could be thought of as Gnostic. And Taussig points out two big problems with her approach. First, by accepting the terms Gnostic, Gnosis, and Gnosticism, Taussig feels Pagels implies that all of the Nag Hammadi documents belong together and are consistent expressions of a single system of beliefs and thought. So by saying these are Gnostic Gospels or Gnostic documents, it sort of says they all have something in common. They all have common beliefs and teachings. And that was a good thing for Pagels to say when she was saying this, because she was pioneering the exploration of these non-canonical books from the Nag Hammadi Library. That was her scholarly focus. But she went too far. In oversimplifying it for public consumption, she painted the brush a little too broadly. And that idea leads logically to the conclusion that there was a system of thought in early Christian times known as Gnosticism. Now, that's interesting because if you look at the early writings of the early church fathers, some of the people I mentioned tonight, Tertullian and Tatian and so forth, Eusebius, they will tell you that Gnosticism was heretical. Gnosticism was the set of teachings that had to be rooted out, stomped, burned in the fire, people killed, and they were, for allegedly teaching Gnostic ideas and Gnostic thoughts. At its simplest and at its essence, Gnosticism is the belief that you are saved, redeemed, atoned, whatever word you choose to use there for the notion of redemption, by your knowledge of the divine, which is secret until it's revealed to you by some person or group which has access to those secrets and a ritual for proving yourself worthy of receiving them. And that's the fundamental problem with the idea that these are Gnostic teachings, right? Because it makes them not accessible to anybody who isn't part of some cult or group or church or community or following some specific teacher. So while there is, and we'll see in this one book we're going to study tonight, while there is a lot of respect for, admiration for, even adoration of wisdom and teaching and wisdom teachings in the contents of the books in the Nag Hammadi Library, they are not Gnostic in the sense that they have this notion of a secret cult, secret handshake, preparation you have to do to make yourself worthy to receive them. Those are the aspects of Gnosticism that Taussig rebels against and says are not really fully present in the New Testament library, in the Nag Hammadi Library. And he also says the fact is there was never such a movement in Christianity. There were Gnostics in various pockets of beliefs around, but there was never a single movement or a single group that you could characterize as first century Gnosticism or Gnostics. There were just isolated pockets of people who put up Gnostic blocks, obstacles to justify not sharing the truth that they had stashed away in a corner somewhere until you went through some ritual that they dictated to get at it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so they wanted, they made themselves kind of special, right?
They exactly. Like they made themselves gatekeepers.
Club, right? Yeah. Okay.
They were like the original Masons.
Yeah, I went there too.
Right. Did you? Yeah.
I went there. Probably where it comes from.
Could be. Yeah, could be. I don't know.
The Knights Templar and all that.
Yep.
Well, you could almost say the monks or stuff like that could be Gnostic. I mean, in that, you know, I was a nun for a while. I got to go know their secrets, but
right.
as soon as I'm out, you're out.
Yep.
You're out or
yep.
you're in.
That's
you
right,
know?
Yep.
Well,
and, and there are a couple of other observations to make on that. You know, the Mormon Church today has all of their all of the people who are Mormon Church who become elders have to get if they're married have to be married in the temple mm-hmm. through a ceremony that's very much like the Masonic orders specific rituals with all sorts. I've been through it, so I know exactly what it contained. That's an amazingly strange, bizarre, and weird experience to go through.
With hand motions and everything, right?
Hand motions and agreements to be disemboweled if you tell a secret, and I mean a lot of other just bizarre stuff. And there's no real theology there. It's all about these inner secrets, right? It's all keeping track, right? Now it's true that, and this is an interesting side observation that I would make about this subject. The Catholic Church, until relatively recently, not last week, but relatively recently historically, discouraged its members from reading the Bible.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was why the services were in Latin. The Latin Vulgate was the only version of the Bible that was usable, and so forth, because they wanted the priests to be the intermediaries mm-hmm. for the congregants
right.
to God or Mary or Jesus. And that seems a little Gnostic to me. At least it smacks of Gnosticism if it isn't Gnosticism.
Right, you're not the special group. Right?
That's right. Exactly. So.
How about Scientology?
Yeah. I prefer to stay with Christian ideas, Christian sects.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I'm sure they do some of that, a lot of that as well, yeah. So I wanted to get that off the out of the way because we do keep running across the idea of Gnosticism as we read sources other than Taussig on the Nag Hammadi Library, because his thinking about this new approach to Gnosticism is fairly recent, and there's still a lot of still literature around that treats the Nag Hammadi Library as principally a Gnostic library, and
I'm
it isn't.
This argument with Dan as we speak.
Oh, yeah.
I'm copiously taking it because I know there's going to be an after discussion.
Yeah.
Well,
so.
Idea of what Gnosticism meant. I've always, up till now, assumed that it just simply meant I don't know and I'm trying to figure it out. You know,
that's agnosticism.
And that's agnosticism.
Yep.
So I've had it really mixed up.
Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, we are now finished with our general introduction and overview of the book and the course that we're going to be working on together over the next six coming tonight. And I'd be love to have any open discussion you want to have before we dive into the first actual book we're going to look at. So if you have anything you want to cover on this subject, this is the time to do it. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
You know we won't hold our peace.
I know that, yeah.
We don't even know how. We don't know yet.
You don't even know there is a peace.
We don't know enough quite yet to ask us or throw out. Or.
So this is really a radical thing to break up this idea of Gnosticism.
It's a radical idea
to
approach the Nag Hammadi literature as in that way and to sort of defuse the teaching, the idea of Gnosticism being this heretical movement. Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
is there anyone else doing that, or is that unique to?
Oh no, several people in the Jesus Seminar are supporters of his and this idea. I don't even know. I wouldn't even say for sure that he's the guy who originated it,
okay.
But he's certainly one of the major proponents of it.
If I got this right, this guy Hal Taussig, and what he did, he's inviting new ideas to come from.
That's right. That's right.
He's inviting discussion.
That's right.
And yeah, that's the fascinating.
He explains thing. Early in the book why he calls it a new Testament and not the new Testament, because he says this is just a first attempt. Other groups, other scholars, other students are going to come along and they're going to say, well, why, we need, well, you're right, but you know, we could add these books. We could organize it this topical way. Here's some more historical evidence you didn't take into account, and keep expanding on this idea. He's just seeding the idea that we don't need to make the New Testament canon that we have be a negative experience because it doesn't have all the truth. Because it's been promulgated by under some fair, sort of sneaky political agendas and so forth. Nor do we need to put all these newly discovered non-canonical books on some sort of pedestal and say they're not wrong. They're look all the clarification they're doing and so forth. But to treat them as equally parts of the emerging story of what Christianity and the Christ movements were like.
So, what do you think his ultimate goal, if everything is perfect, would be achieved from?
I think he's achieved his ultimate goal. His ultimate goal was to start a conversation in the Christian movement about these ideas. I suspect that Taussig will probably have another book in 5 or 10 years that will expand on this. I hope he doesn't call it a new Testament, because it's starting to get old pretty well. But you know, it's but I think
you have to realize these writings are within a certain time period.
That's right.
I mean, there's strict criteria.
That's right. That's right.
I think one book they used outside or something.
Yeah,
said?
Yeah, one. Yep.
Yeah, but it's from like 30 to 175, whatever they could.
Purposely limited.
Yeah.
Purposely limited the scope
purposely
of the work to make this an achievable task.
Right.
And you know he's and you know it's, there's no back cover on this as far as he's concerned. Let's keep going.
Let's keep
talking
going,
about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And that's what he says. That was his purpose.
Yep.
Have you written to him yet?
No.
He does so many times when he reads a book. And
you mean he emails them?
Calls. Yeah.
I'm not sure I won't, but I haven't done it yet.
Is he your friend on Facebook
yet? He's not on Facebook. I look for him.
Is he in Northern California?
I think he's back in the. He's back east somewhere. He's Union. He's in New York. He teaches at UTS. So. That purple box at the bottom. He says he teaches at Union Theological Seminary, and he's back in. Actually has a pastorate back there. So, okay, then what we're going to do next is we're going to take our first deep dive into one book. This may or may not take the rest of our time, but it'll be interesting to see where we all go with it. So this is a copy of the entire text of the book called The Prayer of Thanksgiving.
That's it?
That's it. This came out of the Nag Hammadi Library. I would say this is transcendently Gnostic.
Transcendently Gnostic.
In the sense that it actually is what we call a Hermetic text.
Is transcendently a word or is it transcendentally?
No, transcendent is transcendently is a word, yeah. That's what I'm about to explain. So this is a text that has some flavor of Gnosticism. We're going to read it together here shortly, but it's what we call a Hermetic text in proper scholarly terms. Hermeticism is a theological or philosophical school of thought based on the writings of an ancient pagan teacher. His name was Hermes Trismegistus. Hermes Trismegistus. I'm going to spell it Trismegistus. Trismegistus.
Say it again. It sounds like a dinosaur.
Trismegistus. It does sound like a dinosaur, doesn't it?
It does.
And that word means. Three times wise.
Three times
wise.
Wise.
Or thrice wise, right?
Three times wise. That's easier to say than
now. Here's what's really interesting. This guy's a pagan writer whose writing precedes the development, precedes the birth of Jesus by a number of years. But a lot of early church fathers, some of the people I mentioned tonight and others, saw this guy, whose name I'm never going to say again. My old buddy Hermes. As a wise prophet who foretold the birth and death of Jesus. The basic idea that Hermes promulgates in his teachings, which is called this Hermetic tradition or the Hermetic text, is that there, and this is where I'm coming back to you, what we taught earlier, T, there is a single divine truth which God gave to man at the beginning of time and which man has spent all of the time since then corrupting and misunderstanding.
All this time doing what?
Corrupting and misunderstanding, right, yeah. Well, his name is Hermes. I guess he would have maybe a Greek background, yeah. It's a Greek word, Greek god, so yeah, probably.
It's a Greek god. Huh?
But he was a pagan. Most of those early
witches were
pagan.
Pagan,
religion of the earth.
Religion of the earth.
Yeah, right.
Nice.
Yeah.
They believe in
there are a lot of pagans today. Yeah. Krista knows a pagan.
I have two.
Two pagans.
Do they believe in a higher power?
Yeah.
Yeah. But their higher power would be Gaia.
But it's Gaia, so it's
Earth.
Earth,
exactly, right, yes, yeah. Right. Okay. Right, yep.
They do rituals.
Which is very consistent with indigenous. I think they have
different gods and goddesses.
They do. Yeah. And the Wiccans are a part of the pagan movement and so forth, yeah. So, yeah.
Sorry.
It's a healthy group today. I mean, there's a lot of people around doing this.
Yeah,
there's a resurgence of it in the last 20 years.
College.
Yeah.
We think pagan was so bad.
Yeah, it's a word that we take to be derogatory, right? Yeah, right.
You
filthy pagan, exactly. Right, yeah.
They make it seem satanic. Is that because they were idolatrous and all that stuff? Right?
What's that?
Didn't the Catholic Church look at anyone that wasn't a follower of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, yeah.
Pagans.
Yeah, pagans are Jews. Yeah.
But these days, pagan doesn't have that bad of a feeling to it.
Well, it doesn't in California.
Yeah, exactly.
I keep having to remind myself that, you know, if you go to Missouri, being a pagan is probably not a good thing. That's where some of her friends live. Right?
Alabama.
Two pagans in Alabama. They probably don't want to go around saying that much, you know. So this document we're going to read, they're going to share together here, is a prayer. And it's cast as a part of a worship experience built around a festive community meal. Although Jesus' name isn't specifically mentioned, it refers to a bloodless meal, which would strongly signal Christian belief in the early church because the blood and the meal going together around the communion practice. The language in this poem is incredibly powerful and imaginative, evoking deep feelings more than theology or belief kinds of responses. Just as we'll find with the Odes of Solomon, this poetry isn't about teaching theology. This poetry is about getting to the gut feeling, emotional attachment and engagement and involvement with Christ, the Christ spirit and the early teachings. Tostig says that one of the advantages of this poem and the odes and some other things that he's going to talk to us about is that this prayer provides a model that's different from what he calls the lockstep formula of later Christianity, the rote praying. The prayers that are just theological in nature, they're about head, they're about teachings and beliefs. And he says that it therefore encourages Christ followers today to explore their emotional responses to the divine in extraordinary ways. Now, of course, this is in the Christian tradition. If you're in the Sufi tradition, they've got a huge body of poetic literature. In fact, there's more poetry in Sufism than there is theology. But here, in our culture, in the Christian culture, this kind of thing isn't a prominent feature of our worship experience.
But you said encourages Christians today to explore their
emotional responses to the divine, rather than focusing on the head stuff, the teaching stuff.
Emotions were bad.
Exactly. They still are, by the way, but we're not telling you that anymore. My emotions are bad, I should say that. So I'd like to have us read this, and what I'd suggest we do is start over here with Marcia and just read the first sentence or two, and then we'll go around the table. At a couple of points, I'm gonna ask you to pause while I make a point. So,
okay.
We give thanks.
I don't like this. But go ahead.
We give thanks to you. Every soul and heart is lifted up to you, undisturbed, name honored with the name God and praised with the name Father. For to everyone and everything comes the fatherly kindness and affection and love, and any teaching there may be that is sweet and plain, giving us mind, speech, and knowledge.
Okay, stop there.
I mean, it's such a long sentence.
It is, huge long sentence.
Couldn't do the whole thing.
Right, that's fine. No, I've got a marker there.
Okay.
So the next phrase, I'm going to read the next phrases here myself. So he, having said this, giving us mind, speech, and knowledge, the writer of this prayer says the reasons for those three things. Mind, so that we may understand you. That sounds a little Gnostic, doesn't it? Awareness, knowledge of divine being a key part of the practice. Speech, so that we may expound you, which isn't necessarily Gnostic in itself, and knowledge, this is really powerful, knowledge, so that we may know you. Knowledge, so that we may know you. That's, again, part of this whole Gnostic Hermetic milieu that I was talking about at the beginning here. So, the prayer is rejoicing over the awareness, the enlightenment, the knowledge that they've been given through this connection with God. Who they said here is Father, but it's going to go off. It's going to go off in a slightly weird direction here shortly. So, Mary, I want you to read the next sentence, starting with "We rejoice."
We start at mind.
We
start.
Rejoice.
We rejoice. Top of this next.
Oh. We rejoice, having been illuminated by your knowledge. We rejoice because you have shown us yourself.
Yeah. Good. Stop there. So illuminated. That sounds a little Gnostic, doesn't it?
Because it's inner knowing.
Right, inner knowing, and it's and it feels like illumination, light being shed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And shown us yourself. So I have, as a prayer of this prayer, I am thanking God for having shown me his or her divine presence in my life in a personal, impactful kind of way. Mm-hmm. Again, fairly Gnostic in its kind of flavor. Sue?
So we rejoice while we were in the body, you have made us divine through your knowledge.
That last sentence, that's a really powerful clause, isn't it?
While we were divine. You have
made us divine through your knowledge. Your knowledge has liberated us. Your knowledge
while
has delivered us.
Body, you have made us divine
right.
Through
and that's the key point, right? While we were still in the body, while we were still embodied, while we were still physically here, you've enlightened us, illuminated us by revealing yourself to us through your knowledge. Okay. Patty?
The thanksgiving of the man who attains to you is one thing that we know. That we know you.
Okay, stop there.
We have known you, intellectual light.
Okay, that's good. So, the thanksgiving of the person who attains to you, who has had this knowledge that was referred to in the previous sentence, is that we know you, have that knowing, that wisdom, that insight, that knowledge. Again, this is very hermetical stuff in terms of the way the way that this is all being presented to us. We have known you, intellectual light, not uplifting, spiritual, but intellectual light. That's an important word there. Okay. Ted?
Life of life, we have known you.
Okay, stop there. So now it's life of life. Now God takes on this. We're transitioning to a new approach, dimension of God here. God starts out as knowledge, right? Understanding, wisdom, illumination. Now it's life of life we have known you. So it's just a little switch in tone. Krista?
Womb of every creature, we have known you. Womb pregnant with the nature of the Father, we have known
you. Okay, stop there. Now he makes it, the author of this prayer makes a pretty interesting twisted jump here and talks about the father having a womb.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
This is a way of the writer of the prayer attributing to God, the Father, the divine, the power of creation. Okay, so the womb becomes a symbol of creation, and that's the thing that we're now saying that we're praising God for. So we've had all these different aspects of God presented in this very short prayer so far, and we're not done yet. Okay?
Eternal permanence of the begetting Father, this have we worshipped, your goodness. There is one petition that we ask, we would be preserved in knowledge.
Okay, good. We would be preserved in knowledge. Again, we're coming back to Gnosticism now, right? We're going from eternal permanence of the begetting Father, the begetting Father, the creative Father, right? Thus have we worshipped your goodness.
But God is good. The creation is good.
Right. Creation is good. God is good. And there's one petition that we ask. Only one thing we want. We would be preserved in knowledge, that we would be, that our we would find our salvation, our atonement in knowledge. Knowledge being the refuge. T?
And there is one protection that we desire, that we do not stumble in this kind of life.
Good. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Not stumble in this kind of life. This kind of, what's this kind of life?
In the knowledge.
Of life of knowledge, right?
Life of knowledge.
Michelle?
When they had said these things in the prayer, they embraced each other and they went to eat their holy food, which has no blood in it.
Great. The holy food was the sacrament, right, of the festive sacrament of the celebration of the life of Jesus, of mocking and imitating the Last Supper. Why has no blood in it. I don't know. Well, you tell me. What does it say to you in this context?
It has no blood in it.
It sounds like he's talking about before the sacrifice of Jesus as a lamb against Molech.
Well, this is a second century document, so it's probably not connected to that.
Well, when they had the bread and wine, there's no blood in that.
But Jesus said
the wine is
right,
blood.
I know,
right.
But
so,
is it really?
And you hit the nail there. The teaching was that the wine became the blood, right? That idea was just beginning to kind of become circulated in the church. Some people were teaching that. And this particular phrase is in here because these people rejected that idea.
Of transubstantiation.
Right. That there was any blood. It was,
seems to me they're talking about the holy food. It's not the food itself.
That's right.
It's the knowledge.
That's right.
The essence.
And why is there no blood in it?
Because it's not the physical.
That's right, because it's transcendent.
Right.
It's the truth, the knowledge, the wisdom, the holy food they're imbibing isn't. Because you would expect if you're going to eat food, it would have blood, right? If meat of some sort would have blood, right?
I thought they meant that they were vegan.
They're all vegetarian or something. Yeah, that's where I went, too.
I didn't think
the original vegans. That's where I went, too. Hey, who knows?
So that's why you're saying this is hermetic or whatever, because
right,
they're talking about that divine truth.
Right.
They're talking about the divine,
that central divine truth. Right. Right. Yep.
So, which is knowledge, right?
Which, right. Knowledge and wisdom. Right.
So,
exactly.
So, what does that have to do with blood?
It doesn't. It would have something to do with blood if it were physical.
Right.
I need to excuse myself for a moment.
I see.
Talk among yourselves.
Yes. So the holy food.
Because I was thinking,
you're still being recorded.
Jesus always did things. He always talked in parables, but he wasn't saying that the wine really is blood. It wasn't blood.
We created.
You know,
people created that, right?
You know, but it was right. No blood. It was no blood at all. But I thought he was talking about sacrificial.
Right.
Him being sacrificed as a lamb.
Well, they're saying here that the holy food is truth, knowledge, and wisdom.
Truth, not the physical, not the physical,
not
right.
The physical.
So they were eating a spiritual food.
The holy food,
yeah.
With knowledge.
Yeah.
With knowledge.
Sure.
going to be spinning. You'll be lying there trying to sleep going, oh, God.
Now, this prayer would never be embraced by the Catholicism that I was.
Not at all.
Right. Not at all.
And many, many churches of our times.
Yeah.
True.
Because we were the lowly peasants who had to go through the priests and beg, you know.
I never understood that. Why would I tell this man anything about me?
Because
I never understood that.
Because they could keep their flocks
kept us under control.
Under control.
I wouldn't give a negative motivation. I think they did the best they could.
They came off.
I told them, you came off.
Certainly bodily pleasures and all that can.
It's very
distracting and leads to crazy things.
That's the same thing, disfellowshipping.
Yeah.
That's the same thing.
Taking care of the holidays,
holidays
and
birthday. You don't celebrate your birthday because John Baptist Higgins.
We are really off the rails.
Finally, he ran out of answers in my office. He ran out of answers. He said, "So, I said, so tell me about these holidays. Show me.
Yeah.
I've been there. Show me."
Oh, they can't.
He did. He said, "Well, we had to come up with something." I said, "That's what I thought." Discussion is ended here.
Let's go have a drink.
Man, I don't know. Get me started.
You showed up here on a very interesting night.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to go listen after he said what he's going to
talk
about.
Almost every time we do this, we go away going, going away with more questions
than answers.
Answers. At least I do. I speak for myself.
So there's this, at the end of the document, there's this thing called a scribal note, which is an interesting appendage, because what it basically says is this is coming from the person who wrote down the prayer.
Originally.
Yeah, the original. And he says, I have copied this one discourse of his. We have no idea who his is here. But indeed, very many have come to me. I have not copied them because I thought that they had come to you, to all the people he was addressing here. Also, I hesitate to copy these for you because perhaps they have already come to you and the matter may burden you, since the discourses of that one which have come to me are numerous.
This
so,
is all in the original document?
Yep. So, this is a person, the scribe saying, I got a lot of this stuff. I'm not going to give it to you because I think you probably already have it all, and I'm not going to be doing any service by doing that. You may even find it like troubling or burdensome or whatever. But I'm going to give you this one that I've transcribed it for you, and there's no explanation for why the scribe would say that. But there you have it.
And do we know to whom he was saying it?
No, we don't have any idea who the addressee is here at all, though.
So I kind of forgot what you said at the beginning about this. Was this a prayer that was used in the early church?
Right.
It was used.
This is a prayer that was found in circumstances that suggest that it was part of a worship service built around a festive meal.
In the early church,
we've
right.
We've come a long ways from there.
This document, by the way, that we're talking about here has the unusual property of being almost perfectly preserved. The manuscript from which this was taken in the Nagamati Library was in very good shape. So.
Plus, it's timely because it's almost Thanksgiving. Right?
He says, there's a guy named Douglas Parrott. Who's the guy who translated this, and he's got a commentary on it. And here I wanted to share one more piece with you. He says, this prayer itself reflects liturgical usage as its balanced language attests. So this place where he says, we do mind and knowledge, and those are kind of like responsive readings or places where the community could say something like, you know, amen or whatever. So they were like, so you can see some structure to a particular aspect of the worship service contained in the way the poem is put together.
Of
While it's not possible to assign a date to this document and to the communities to which it was addressed, he said it's reasonable to assume that they flourished in the second and third centuries CE, perhaps a little earlier. Now, one thing that's interesting, I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail because we'll get into it, I think, next week or the week after, but the Odes of Solomon that we're going to look at in several different times during the course of this class have analogies of treating God, Father, Creator as having breasts and giving milk, which is this divine wisdom. Now, that brings a whole other round of meaning back into the Christian teaching and the teaching of creation.
You said the Father in this has breasts.
Right. In the Odes of Solomon that we're going to be looking at, one of the passages I'm looking at today. The only reason I brought it up is because he talks about here, you know, God the Father having a womb, which is a pretty startling metaphor. But then the Odes of Solomon goes even farther. So it's like. On some level, one of the commentators I was reading, on some level, it's like the point we're trying to make, he says, is that God doesn't have gender.
Right.
And so we're going to make this God have these characteristics that you think of as strictly female and also these characteristics you think of as strictly male, and we're going to put them all into one entity because we don't want you to think of God as male or female. So, I mean, that's an interesting
good.
Idea that you probably wouldn't find much in the modern church.
No,
except that we do it all the time, right? We say Mother, Father, God.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we use that. I think in our community we're probably pretty well agreed that we would not see God as having gender. But in the first few centuries of Christianity, that was a pretty heretical idea. That kind of content would be a reason someone could argue that material didn't belong in the canon.
Maybe that's what it really was.
That's what I'm thinking.
Maybe this is how it really started, and we went the other way, as opposed to this, it started this way, and this became the other way.
There are a lot of people who believe that, and of course they're somewhat debunked by this by the recent conversations about Gnosticism. But there are a lot of people who believed in a broad sense, that the early church could have been divided into two camps. And one camp would have been more of a spiritual path, and the other church model would have been more of an organizational, structural, power structure, kind of hierarchical path. And that Constantine signaled strongly that he wanted to do something he could control,
right, yeah.
Which you could never do with a singular spiritual path.
Right.
And so that in these early discussions and debates, that community that was interested in things like this gender-free God.
Sense
exactly.
To me that this is really, my words, the way.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then because of wanting to control the masses or what have you, then it kind of went away from this.
Right. And what Taussig would say, and I would agree with him, is that what we can draw from this is the idea that there isn't, neither of those is necessarily by itself an entirely accurate or correct way of worshiping and following the teachings of Jesus, that both you need to go to a both and.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the extant church
right.
went heavily in one direction,
right.
And that's why today we have people who are spiritual but not religious, and we're losing followers in the Christian movement and so forth, is because we've gone too far, the pendulum has swung so far in that direction that it alienates those who have an emotional or a spiritual path and attachment to the
mm-hmm.
to the divine and the truth. So
we still retain certain symbolic phrases.
We do.
Like milk of human kindness.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the land of milk and honey, right? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could I ask again?
Sure.
What Hermes Trismegistic relationship has to this prayer, the pagan writer?
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
So when you go back to look at all those passages that I highlighted, they, taken together, they seem to indicate a Hermetic tradition, which I said is sort of like Gnosticism, super Gnosticism or Gnosticism expanded. right? Because transcendentally hermetic. And hermeticism is the philosophy that takes that idea of this secret knowledge and takes this, doesn't necessarily embody the secret idea, but takes this idea that there is that one divine teaching, there's one divine truth that God gave to man, and that that's the essence of all of this, and that that's, so that's embodied in these, in the highlighted statements that I shared with you this evening.
Thank you.
So it's a hermetic document in that sense.
And that's talking about that divine truth.
Right.
Fascinating.
What does it say about the moon?